The Golden Bough. A Study of Magic and Religion. By Sir James George Frazer. This audiobook was produced by Klaus-Dieter Mond, Rastatt, Germany and is published under the conditions of the Gutenberg Organization. Chapter 25. Temporary Kings. In some places the modified form of the old custom of regicide which appears to have prevailed at Babylon has been further softened down. The king still abdicates annually for a short time and his place is filled by a more or less nominal sovereign. But at the close of his short reign the latter is no longer killed, though sometimes a mock execution still survives as a memorial of the time when he was actually put to death. To take examples. In the month of Meek, February, the king of Cambodia annually abdicated for 3 days. During this time he performed no act of authority, he did not touch the seals, he did not even receive the revenues which fell due. In his stead there reigned a temporary king called Stajmeek, that is, King February. The office of temporary king was hereditary in a family distantly connected with the royal house, the sons succeeding the fathers and the younger brothers the elder brothers just as in the succession to the real sovereignty. On a favorable day fixed by the astrologers the temporary king was conducted by the mandarins in triumphal procession. He rode one of the royal elephants, seated in the royal palanquin, and escorted by soldiers who, dressed in appropriate costumes, represented the neighboring peoples of Siam, Annam, Laos, and so on. In place of the golden crown he wore a peaked white cap, and his regalia, instead of being of gold and crusted with diamonds, were of rough wood. After paying homage to the real king, from whom he received the sovereignty for 3 days, together with all the revenues accruing during that time, though this last custom has been omitted for some time, he moved in procession round the palace and through the streets of the capital. On the third day, after the usual procession, the temporary king gave orders that the elephants should trample underfoot the mountain of rice, which was a scaffold of bamboo surrounded by sheaves of rice. The people gathered up the rice, each man taking home a little with him to secure a good harvest. Some of it was also taken to the king, who had it cooked and presented to the monks. In Siam on the sixth day of the moon in the sixth month, the end of April, a temporary king is appointed, who for 3 days enjoys the royal prerogatives, the real king remaining shut up in his palace. This temporary king sends his numerous satellites in all directions to seize and confiscate whatever they can find in the bazaar and open shops. Even the ships and junks which arrive in harbor during the 3 days are forfeited to him and must be redeemed. He goes to a field in the middle of the city, whither they bring a gilded plough drawn by gaily decked oxen. After the plough has been anointed and the oxen rubbed with incense, the mock king traces 9 furrows with the plough, followed by aged dames of the palace scattering the first seed of the season. As soon as the 9 furrows are drawn, the crowd of spectators rushes in and scrambles for the seed which has just been sown, believing that, mixed with the seed rice, it will ensure a plentiful crop. Then the oxen are unyoked, and rice, maize, sesame, sago, bananas, sugarcane, melons, and so on, are set before them. Whatever they eat first will, it is thought, be dear in the year following, though some people interpret the omen in the opposite sense. During this time the temporary king stands leaning against a tree with his right foot resting on his left knee. From standing thus on one foot he is popularly known as King Hop. But his official title is Fearfulathep, Lord of the Heavenly Hosts. He is a sort of minister of agriculture. All disputes about fields, rice, and so forth, are referred to him. There is moreover another ceremony in which he personates the king. It takes place in the second month, which falls in the cold season, and lasts 3 days. He is conducted in procession to an open place opposite the temple of the Brahmins, where there are a number of poles dressed like maypoles, upon which the Brahmins swing. All the while that they swing and dance, the Lord of the Heavenly Hosts has to stand on one foot upon a seat which is made of bricks plastered over, covered with a white cloth, and hung with tapestry. He is supported by a wooden frame with a gilt canopy, and two Brahmins stand one on each side of him. The dancing Brahmins carry buffalo horns with which they draw water from a large copper cauldron and sprinkle it on the spectators. This is supposed to bring good luck, causing the people to dwell in peace and quiet, health and prosperity. The time during which the Lord of the Heavenly Hosts has to stand on one foot is about 3 hours. This is thought to prove the dispositions of the devatas and spirits. If he lets his foot down, he is liable to forfeit his property and have his family enslaved by the king, as it is believed to be a bad omen, portending destruction to the state, and instability to the throne. But if he stand firm, he is believed to have gained a victory over evil spirits, and he has moreover the privilege, ostensibly at least, of seizing any ship which may enter the harbor during these 3 days, and taking its contents, and also of entering any open shop in the town and carrying away what he chooses. Such were the duties and privileges of the Siamese king Hop down to about the middle of the 19th century or later. Under the reign of the late enlightened monarch, this quaint personage was to some extent both shorn of the glories and relieved of the burden of his office. He still watches, as of old, the Brahmins rushing through the air in a swing suspended between two tall masts, each some 90 feet high. But he is allowed to sit instead of stand, and, although public opinion still expects him to keep his right foot on his left knee during the whole of the ceremony, he would incur no legal penalty were he, to the great chagrin of the people, to put his weary foot to the ground. Other signs, too, tell of the invasion of the East by the ideas and civilization of the West. The thoroughfares that lead to the scene of the performance are blocked with carriages, lampposts and telegraph posts, to which eager spectators cling like monkeys, rise above the dense crowd. And, while a tattered Himalayan band of the old style, in gaudy garb of vermilion and yellow, bangs and tootles away on drums and trumpets of an antique pattern, the procession of barefooted soldiers in brilliant uniforms steps briskly along to the lively strains of a modern military band playing, marching through Georgia. On the first day of the 6th month, which was regarded as the beginning of the year, the king and people of Samarkand used to put on new clothes and cut their hair and beards. Then they repaired to a forest near the capital where they shot arrows on horseback for 7 days. On the last day the target was a gold coin, and he who hit it had the right to be king for 1 day. In Upper Egypt on the first day of the solar year by Coptic reckoning, that is, on the 10th of September, when the Nile has generally reached its highest point, the regular government is suspended for 3 days and every town chooses its own ruler. This temporary lord wears a sort of tall fool's cap and a long flaxen beard, and is enveloped in a strange mantle. With a wand of office in his hand and attended by men disguised as scribes, executioners, and so forth, he proceeds to the governor's house. The latter allows himself to be deposed. And the mock king, mounting the throne, holds a tribunal, to the decisions of which even the governor and his officials must bow. After 3 days the mock king is condemned to death. The envelope or shell in which he was encased is committed to the flames, and from its ashes the fellah creeps forth. The custom perhaps points to an old practice of burning a real king in grim earnest. In Uganda the brothers of the king used to be burned, because it was not lawful to shed the royal blood. The Mohammedan students of Fez, in Morocco, are allowed to appoint a sultan of their own, who reigns for a few weeks, and is known as Sultan Tihyfentelba, the Sultan of the Scribes. This brief authority is put up for auction and knocked down to the highest bidder. It brings some substantial privileges with it, for the holder is freed from taxes thenceforward, and he has the right of asking a favor from the real sultan. That favor is seldom refused. It usually consists in the release of a prisoner. Moreover, the agents of the student sultan levy fines on the shopkeepers and householders, against whom they trump up various humorous charges. The temporary sultan is surrounded with the pomp of a real court, and parades the streets in state with music and shouting, while a royal umbrella is held over his head. with the so-called fines and freewill offerings, to which the real Sultan adds a liberal supply of provisions, the students have enough to furnish forth a magnificent banquet. And altogether they enjoy themselves thoroughly, indulging in all kinds of games and amusements. For the first 7 days the mock Sultan remains in the college. Then he goes about a mile out of the town and encamps on the bank of the river, attended by the students and not a few of the citizens. On the 7th day of his stay outside the town he is visited by the real Sultan, who grants him his request and gives him 7 more days to reign, so that the reign of the Sultan of the Scribes nominally lasts 3 weeks. But when 6 days of the last week have passed, the mock Sultan runs back to the town by night. This temporary sultanship always falls in spring, about the beginning of April. Its origin is said to have been as follows. When Mullah Rashid II was fighting for the throne in 1664 or 1665, a certain Jew usurped the royal authority at Tazak. But the rebellion was soon suppressed through the loyalty and devotion of the students. To effect their purpose they resorted to an ingenious stratagem. 40 of them caused themselves to be packed in chests which were sent as a present to the usurper. In the dead of night, while the unsuspecting Jew was slumbering peacefully among the packing cases, the lids were stealthily raised, the brave 40 crept forth, slew the usurper, and took possession of the city in the name of the real Sultan, who, to mark his gratitude for the help thus rendered him in time of need, conferred on the students the right of annually appointing a sultan of their own. The narrative has all the air of a fiction devised to explain an old custom, of which the real meaning and origin had been forgotten. A custom of annually appointing a mock king for a single day was observed at Lostwithiel in Cornwall down to the 16th century. On Little Easter Sunday, the freeholders of the town and manor assembled together, either in person or by their deputies, and one among them, as it fell to his lot by turn, gaily attired and gallantly mounted, with a crown on his head, a scepter in his hand, and a sword borne before him, rode through the principal street to the church, dutifully attended by all the rest on horseback. The clergyman in his best robes received him at the churchyard stile and conducted him to hear divine service. On leaving the church he repaired, with the same pomp, to a house provided for his reception. Here a feast awaited him and his suite, and being set at the head of the table he was served on bended knees, with all the rites due to the estate of a prince. The ceremony ended with the dinner, and every man returned home. Sometimes the temporary king occupies the throne, not annually, but once for all at the beginning of each reign. Thus in the kingdom of Jambi and Sumatra it is the custom that at the beginning of a new reign a man of the people should occupy the throne and exercise the royal prerogatives for a single day. The origin of the custom is explained by a tradition that there were once 5 royal brothers, the 4 elder of whom all declined the throne on the ground of various bodily defects, leaving it to their youngest brother. But the eldest occupied the throne for 1 day, and reserved for his descendants a similar privilege at the beginning of every reign. Thus the office of temporary king is hereditary in a family akin to the royal house. In Bilaspur it seems to be the custom, after the death of a Raja, for a Brahmin to eat rice out of the dead Raja's hand, and then to occupy the throne for 1 year. At the end of the year the Brahman receives presents and is dismissed from the territory, being forbidden apparently to return. The idea seems to be that the spirit of the Raja enters into the Brahman who eats liquor, rice and milk, out of his hand when he is dead, as the Brahman is apparently carefully watched during the whole year, and not allowed to go away. The same or a similar custom is believed to obtain among the hill states about Kangra. The custom of banishing the Brahman who represents the king may be a substitute for putting him to death. At the installation of a prince of Carinthia peasant, in whose family the office was hereditary, ascended a marble stone which stood surrounded by meadows in a spacious valley. On his right stood a black mother cow, on his left a lean ugly mare. A rustic crowd gathered about him. Then the future prince, dressed as a peasant and carrying a shepherd's staff, drew near, attended by courtiers and magistrates. On perceiving him, the peasant called out, "Who is this whom I see coming so proudly along?" The people answered, "The prince of the land." The peasant was then prevailed on to surrender the marble seat to the prince on condition of receiving 60 pence, the cow and mare, and exemption from taxes. But before yielding his place, he gave the prince a light blow on the cheek. Some points about these temporary kings deserve to be specially noticed before we pass to the next branch of the evidence. In the first place, the Cambodian and Siamese examples show clearly that it is especially the divine or magical functions of the king which are transferred to his temporary substitute. This appears from the belief that by keeping up his foot the temporary king of Siam gained a victory over the evil spirits, whereas by letting it down he imperiled the existence of the state. Again, the Cambodian ceremony of trampling down the mountain of rice, and the Siamese ceremony of opening the ploughing and sowing, are charms to produce a plentiful harvest, as appears from the belief that those who carry home some of the trampled rice, or of the seed sown, will thereby secure a good crop. Moreover, when the Siamese representative of the king is guiding the plough, the people watch him anxiously, not to see whether he drives a straight furrow, but to mark the exact point on his leg to which the skirt of his silken robe reaches. For on that is supposed to hang the state of the weather and the crops during the ensuing season. If the Lord of the heavenly hosts hitches up his garment above his knee, the weather will be wet and heavy rains will spoil the harvest. If he lets it trail to his ankle, a drought will be the consequence. But fine weather and heavy crops will follow if the hem of his robe hangs exactly halfway down the calf of his leg. So closely is the course of nature, and with it the weal or woe of the people, dependent on the minutest act or gesture of the king's representative. But the task of making the crops grow, thus deposited to the temporary kings, is one of the magical functions regularly supposed to be discharged by kings in primitive society. The rule that the mock king must stand on one foot upon a raised seat in the rice field was perhaps originally meant as a charm to make the crop grow high. At least this was the object of a similar ceremony observed by the old Prussians. The tallest girl, standing on one foot upon a seat, with her lap full of cakes, a cup of brandy in her right hand and a piece of elm bark or linden bark in her left, prayed to the god Wayzganthus that the flax might grow as high as she was standing. Then, after draining the cup, she had it refilled, and poured the brandy on the ground as an offering to Wayzganthus, and threw down the cakes for his attendant sprites. If she remained steady on one foot throughout the ceremony, it was an omen that the flax crop would be good. But if she let her foot down, it was feared that the crop might fail. The same significance perhaps attaches to the swinging of the Brahmins, which the Lord of the Heavenly Hosts had formerly to witness standing on one foot. On the principles of homeopathic or imitative magic, it might be thought that the higher the priests swing, the higher will grow the rice. For the ceremony is described as a harvest festival, and swinging is practiced by the Letts of Russia with the avowed intention of influencing the growth of the crops. In the spring and early summer, between Easter and St. John's Day, the summer solstice, every Lettish peasant is said to devote his leisure hours to swinging diligently. For the higher he rises in the air, the higher will his flax grow that season. In the foregoing cases, the temporary king is appointed annually in accordance with a regular custom. But in other cases, the appointment is made only to meet a special emergency, such as to relieve the real king from some actual or threatened evil by diverting it to a substitute, who takes his place on the throne for a short time. The history of Persia furnishes instances of such occasional substitutes for the Shah. Thus Shah Abbas the Great, being warned by his astrologers in the year 1591 that a serious danger impended over him, attempted to avert the omen by abdicating the throne and appointing a certain unbeliever named Iosufi, probably a Christian, to reign in his stead. The substitute was accordingly crowned, and for 3 days, if we may trust the Persian historians, he enjoyed not only the name and the state but the power of the king. At the end of his brief reign he was put to death, The decree of the stars was fulfilled by this sacrifice. And Abiz, who reascended his throne in a most propitious hour, was promised by his astrologers a long and glorious reign.